The story tells us about Naaman, who was a great man, commander of a great army. He was highly favored by a king who was from Syria. Yet, this man had leprosy. But not only did he have physical leprosy, also, as we learned last week and heard again told this week, he had a heart deeply flawed by the leprosy of pride. And like Naaman, we may have a great life, accomplish many great things, or will accomplish many great things, but we all have a spot of the leprosy of some kind of sin in all our hearts. It might be pride, it could also be jealousy, it could be insecurity, it could be all, whatever. And so we learned last week too, when we suffer outwardly, to let us beware of the inward disease of our hearts that need to be healed by Jesus and his forgiveness. Well, this week, I want to draw out another important theme from this story and some very important lessons. And here's the theme. The theme is that Nathan, if you notice, who does he go to for help? He goes to the king. But God only speaks to him through slaves. Naaman believes he has to go to somebody's in the world for help, whereas God helps him through so-called nobodies. Naaman first gets the idea of a cure for his leprosy from a little slave girl, and then he gets the message of what the cure will be from Elijah's servant, and in the end, his servants understand the gospel before Naaman does. What does this tell us about ourselves and God? Well, it tells us four things. One, it teaches us that there will be no true spiritual progress in your life until you see that the world cannot give you the solutions to your deepest problems in your heart. All right? It can't give you the solution to your deepest problems in your heart. Now, let's not be too hard on Naaman for a moment. Why does Naaman, who was told by a slave girl that there is a prophet in Israel, and not to go to the prophet, he goes to the king of Israel with a letter. Why does he do that? Because Naaman assumed, as did many others in biblical times and throughout history, that if you want a miracle performed for you, what do? You go to the king. You go to the leader of the nation. Why? Because religion was seen by leaders as a way to control society. How so? Well, the king typically bankrolled the hierarchy of priests, clergy, magicians, whatever you want to call them. And their job was to support the existing power structure. And so when you had a dream, let's say, that needs to be interpreted, you go to the king, and then the king would summon everybody into his court, and they would do his thing. All right? You might recall King Nebuchadnezzar, by the way. The same thing happened with Daniel. When a dream needed to be interpreted, Nebuchadnezzar brought together all the magicians and everything. When they couldn't do it, he brought Daniel in. But Naaman didn't know the country he went for healing, that their prophet was not a puppet of the king. And that's why the king of Israel says to Naaman, "Am I God to give death or life?" In other words, don't come to me for something only God can do. And likewise, the message for us is that the deepest problems in our hearts can't just be solved by psychologists, sociologists, political strategies, or whatever. I'm not saying that we can't be helped by these such people, but we can't just get our solutions there. And sometimes the solution deep down in our hearts is really a question of trust in God, a need for forgiveness of sin, those kind of things that only God can solve. A perfect example of this is when Becky Pipper, the well-known Christian author, she took a class in psychology many years ago. And her professor gave a case study of how a man's hatred for his mother had destroyed his life. So he maps out how it affected his marriage, his job, his parenting, everything in his life. And Becky found the study helpful. But when she asked the professor, "How do you treat his hatred?" the professor in response says, "Well, you have to show the man what's going on in his life, how his hatred is affecting him." But Becky says, no. But how do you resolve it? How do you help him forgive his mother so his hate for her no longer controls him? And the professor turns and looks at her and says, If you're looking for a forgiving heart, you are looking in the wrong department in the university. You're not going to find it here. And other students were kind of stunned. But what he said actually makes lots of sense. He was just saying what the king of Israel said to Naaman. Am I God? Can I kill and make alive? No. Your deepest problems in life can only be solved by God, not the kings of this world. No matter what you think your problems are, whether it's with your spouse, your kids, your father, mother-in-law, whatever, somebody's cheated you, all these things, your real problem deep down, the orientation of your heart, maybe needs forgiveness, etc. Only God can help you there. So first, there can be no real spiritual progress in you unless you see that the world cannot help you in that degree. Second, you'll never meet the real God unless you see there's a prophet in Israel. Naaman goes to the king of Israel. And the king, as I said, tears his clothes. And then Elijah sends a letter to the king to tell Naaman that he will only be healed if he knows there's a prophet in Israel. Well, what does that mean? We'd like to think we're all searching for God in this world. But in most cases, we're not. TV specials on religion say humanity's been searching for God for centuries. But Paul says in the Bible, no one seeks after God. Why does he say that? C.S. Lewis himself said once, the idea that humanity is searching for God is as absurd as the mouse is searching for a cat. We're searching for satisfaction. We're searching for a God we can concoct. We're searching for a God that's comfortable, but we're not searching for the real God. Likewise, Naaman came with money, expecting a God who can be bought. He was expecting he could earn his salvation, and a God that hopefully had some limited authority. He was looking, in other words, for a tame God. Instead, when he came to the prophet, Naaman found a wild, unmanageable God. And in a similar way, we'll never find the true God unless, and this is pretty simple, you go to the prophets and the apostles of the Old and New Testament, through which God reveals himself. Now, it's interesting that people make all kinds of excuses for not turning to the Bible to find God. Maybe it's too archaic, it's patriarchal, it's not historically trustworthy, or I've often heard this, I don't like what Paul says, and on. But they are not the real reasons. The real reason is if you take the Bible seriously, you're going to get a God you can't control. In C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I hope some of you have read it, if not all of you, great children's series. When Lucy finds herself in the enchanted world of Narnia after walking through the wardrobe, she encounters Mr. and Mrs. Beaver with the other kids and asks them about Aslan, who happens to be a lion and represents for Lewis the Jesus figure. And she says, is he a man? Aslan a man, says Mr. Beaver sternly, certainly not. I tell you, he is king of the wood and the son of the great emperor beyond the sea. Don't you know who is the king of the beast? Aslan is the lion, the great lion. Oh, says Susan, I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. That you will, dearie, and no mistake, said Mrs. Beaver. If there's anyone who can appear before God, before Aslan without their knees knocking, that they're either braver than most or else just silly. Then he isn't safe, said Lucy. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Don't you hear what Miss Beaver said to you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. Likewise, that's the sort of God you're going to get when you turn to the Bible. Third, God only speaks through humble, marginal people like Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. Who tells Naaman how and where he could be cured? It's a poor Hebrew slave girl whose family had been destroyed by Naaman's very own armies. And then God speaks through Naaman's servants. And after Naaman hears that all he has to do to be cured for his leprosy is to wash himself in the river, he's furious. Why? Because as we learned last week, it's too easy. If that's all he has to do to be cured, that means anybody can be cured by God. And that's when his servants say to him, If a prophet had asked you to do a great thing to be cured, you would gladly have done it. Why don't you do such an easy thing? Here's the point. In general, it is the humble, the poor, the unsuccessful, sometimes uneducated people who most quickly understand the gospel. Why did Naaman's slaves understand the gospel before he did? Because so-called unsuccessful people know that so-called successful people are lucky, whereas successful people think they are skillful. Unsuccessful people know how hard life is, how weak people are, and they know about the reality of sin, whereas successful people are often diluted about their own sin, and they give themselves a lot more credit than they should. That's the reason why God often speaks through such people. And the same thing happens throughout the Old and the New Testament. It's in people such as Moses, David, Jeremiah, and the apostles. All at first were not, you know, very important people. And we see this even in Jesus. He was not born in Jerusalem, but in Bethlehem. He was not born in the upper neighborhoods of Kingston, but in the north end. He was raised poor, gives his king to illiterate fishermen, and dies a criminal's death. And while he was doing all that, the great kings and philosophers of the day knew nothing about him. Why did then, and does the gospel come in this form? Well, first, the form of Jesus' coming reflects the very nature of the gospel. Acceptance and life in the gospel are humble in nature. It's for those who see themselves as no more deserving or better than anybody else, no matter who they are. And then second, if Jesus had come as, let's say, a real somebody, somebody important, he would never have been crucified. He would never have died for our sins and saved us at the same time. Here's the difficulty for us. We're all like Naaman, really. We are first world somebodies. And that's why Christianity, frankly, is waning in the West and growing in third world countries. Now, that doesn't mean we can't get the gospel. Of course we can. But just don't be surprised that so many in our society don't accept it. And, you know, when I've talked about inviting them to St. John's and sharing stuff, don't be surprised that many will say, oh, kind of nicely, oh, thank you, but won't take you up on it. It's because of this. You know, we're doing so well in life, it's hard to have the humility to accept our need in the gospel. But keep trying, because somebody will. All right, and to my last point. We need thus to emulate this little slave girl. The little girl is in a dismal position. She was like an orphan, delegated to utter servitude and loneliness, whereas Gehazi, new part of the story this week, was a servant of Elijah. He was an intern, and thus he was in line to become the next great prophet in Israel. So you'd think if somebody's going to do something useful to God, it would be Gehazi, right? Yet it's the little girl who changes history, and Gehazi ends up an utter failure. Why? Because she was willing to pay the price for doing something useful for God. And Gehazi was not. Why did Elijah refuse to take Naaman's money in the first place? It wasn't because people shouldn't financially support Israel's prophets and priests. It says that throughout the Old Testament that you should. Elijah says, this is not the right time to take money. Why? Because Naaman was a new convert. And Elijah didn't want him to think, like in other religions, that he had to pay something to be saved by God. So why then does Gehazi run after Naaman to get money from him? He should have known better. Because he was more interested in what the world could give him than what God had to offer him. It's simple as that. Elijah wasn't interested in what the world can give him, and that's why God used him to do great things. But Gehazi could do nothing for God because he was more interested in what the world could give him. You might think at the end of the story that it's kind of cruel. God's judgment on Gehazi is kind of cruel. But Gehazi basically wanted to be like Naaman, so that's what he got. And he became like Naaman. God never does anything bad to anybody on purpose. But God does allow you to get what you want. Even if it's not good for you, that's what you want. That's the path you're going to go down. Now, the little girl could easily have sought something from the world instead of God. In fact, one would think she was in a right to do. She could have sought justice and judgment for the world, for all that Naaman had done to her family. But she didn't. Instead, she said to God, I want justice, but you're my judge and you're my justice. I want my father, but you are my father. Now, how do I know that she was thinking like that? Because it doesn't say it directly. Well, because she had forgiven Naaman. She says to Naaman, if only my master, you would go to the prophet. Notice the tone here. There's a sense of love in her voice towards her master. She doesn't say, ha, you've got leprosy. I hope another finger falls off your hand. Right? You tough. You deserve it. She didn't say that. Many of us probably would have. But she uses instead her own suffering as an opportunity to do something useful in someone else's life for God. Amazing. We've all thought it sometime. Maybe we're thinking about it now. Why does God let bad things happen in my life? God doesn't make them happen, I don't believe. But when they do, they can't be opportunities for you to do great things. When things don't go as you wish in life, you can do two things. You can either blame God for it and turn to the world to help you, or only turn to the world to help you. There are some things in the world that can help you, of course. Or you can put your ultimate trust in God and let the opportunity be where you can do great things for God. You can either be more like Gehazi or you can be more like the slave girl. Some say, though, if only I knew why God let all these things happen to me, if I knew, then, you know, I could do this, this, and that. But let me ask you this question. Do you think the little slave girl in the story knew we'd be talking about her 3,000 or so years later and learning from her? Of course not. Of course not. And likewise, just because you can't see why things are happening in your life, how they're unfolding, don't think great things can happen through that, okay? That God can't make things happen, can't change your heart, and through you, change the hearts of other people and make great things happen, okay? It's always possible. It's always possible. And frankly, isn't that what happened to Jesus? Like this poor slave girl, he was one who he voluntarily became leprous in a way, lost his father, became a slave voluntarily, lost everything. Yet he persevered. He died on a cross so you and everyone else can be saved from their sin. Imagine where we'd be if he didn't do that. Imagine. Think of how the world has changed because of what he did. He changed the world. And likewise, so can you. Amen.